10 days. To Delanor, the scent of smoke was inexorably tied to that of blood. He would have trouble counting how many times he'd performed this same long hike across a fresh battlefield. It had become a habit to perform a kind of autopsy of the fighting as he surveyed its aftermath. One could read the movements of troops by the way the dead had fallen. Swaths of singers there indicated a line had broken and chaos had ruled. Human corpses bunched up against a wide river showed the enemy had used the waters, sluggish, since it had been a few days since the last storm, to push an entire company onto poor footing. Bodies stuck with arrows in the front indicated the first beats of the battle, and arrows in the back indicated the last ones as soldiers broke and fled. He passed many corpses stuck with arrows bearing white goose feathers, a kind of fletching the horn-eaters had delivered in batches to aid the war effort. Blood flowed across the field, seeking little rifts in the stone, places where rainwater had left its mark. The blood here was more orange than red, but the two mixed to make an unwholesome shade, the off-red of a rotting methy fruit. The smoke hung heavy in the air. On a battlefield this far afield, you burned the dead right here, sending only the officers home, already made into statues by the soul-casters. Singer and human bodies smelled the same when they burned, a scent that would always bother him because of a specific battlefield, a specific city, a burned-out scar that was the mark of his greatest failure and his greatest shame. Charnel groups moved through the dead today, solemnly cutting patches from uniforms as each was supposed to have the man's name inked on the back by the quartermaster scribe. Sometimes that didn't happen, or sometimes the writing was ruined in the fighting. Those families would go without closure for the rest of their lives, knowing, but wondering anyway, hoping. Walking among the dead, he couldn't help but hear Taravangian's terrible yet hauntingly logical voice. There was a way to see the war ended. All Dalinar had to do was stop fighting. He wasn't ready yet, but the time might come. Every general knew there was a time to turn your sword point down and deliver it to your enemy with head bowed. Surrender was a valid tactic when your goal was the preservation of your people. At some point, continuing to fight worked contrary to that goal. He could trust that the fused were not intent on extinction. Odium, however, he could not trust. Something told Dalinar the ancient god of humankind, long abandoned, would not view this battlefield with the same regret Dalinar did. He finished his grim survey, Zeth at his side as always. Several Azish generals, each newly decorated for their valor in this battle, also accompanied him, along with two Emuli leaders who were archers. Remarkably, the highest calling among the Emuli army was seen as archery. Dalinar knew his way around a bow, though he'd never considered it a particularly regal weapon, but here it was revered. Dalinar walked a careful line for the local generals. He did not want them to see how much he reviled the deaths. A commander could not afford to revile the work in which he engaged. It did not make them bad men to be proud of their victory or to enjoy tactics and strategy. Dalinar's forces would not get far employing pacifists as field generals. But storms. Ever since he'd conquered the Thrill and sent it to be sunk deep in the ocean, he'd found himself loathing these smells, these sights. That was becoming his deepest secret. The Blackthorn had finally become what men had been accusing him of for years, a soldier who had lost the will to kill. He looped around, leaving the dead behind, instead passing victorious companies feasting in the very shadow of their butchery. He congratulated them, acted like the figurehead he'd made of himself. Of all those he saw, only the mink seemed to notice the truth, that there was a reason Dalinar had worked so hard to find his replacement. The short Herdazian man fell in behind Dalinar.
"The war on Emul is done, as of this battle," the Minx said. "The rest is clean-up. Unless the enemy infuses his troops here with serious resources, which would be incredibly wasteful at this point, we'll own Emul within the month."
"The enemy threw it away," Dalinar said.
"That's a stronger term than I'd use," the Minx said. "They fought. They wanted to hold. At the same time, they knew they couldn't move resources away from Yarkaved right now. That would risk destabilizing there and perhaps lead us to claim it in the coming months. It is well the enemy wants to occupy and rule, not just destroy. They could have thrown enough at us here to end us on this front, but that would have left the rest of their war efforts in ruin. As it is, they knew exactly how many troops to put in Emul to lure us in with a large enough force, but they also knew to cut their losses if the battle turned against them."
"You've been extremely helpful," Dalinar said.
"Just remember your promise. Alethkar next, then Herdaz."
"You're a Theru before both," Dalinar said, "but you have my word. No operations against the Iriali, no attempt to seize Yarkaved until your people are free."
He likely didn't need the promise. The Minx was a wily man and had easily recognized that if Dalinar were ever to recover Alethkar, it would be the best thing that could happen for an eventual recovery of the Minx homeland. Once Yarkaved had gone to the enemy, Herdaz's tactical importance had soared. The Minx departed to go enjoy the post-battle celebration with his personal unit of Herdazian freedom fighters. Dalinar ended up in the small battlefield command tent beside a goblet full of rubies. Couldn't they have been a different color? Storms. It had been a long time since a battle had affected him like this. "It's like I'm drifting in the ocean," he thought. "We won today, but Navani is still trapped." If he couldn't retake Urethiru, everything collapsed. Losing it was a huge setback in his true goal, pushing Odium to be frightened enough to make a deal. So he sprang to his feet with relief when Sigzil, the Windrunner, entered, along with two of his team and Stargyle, the Lightweaver, a handsome man with a soldier's build and a ready smile. The name was a little much. Dalinar doubted he'd had that one since birth, but he had a reputation for friendliness, and the light-eyed women of the court certainly seemed to think highly of him. Like the other Lightweavers, the man refused to wear a uniform, something about not feeling right wearing it again. Indeed, he bowed to Dalinar instead of saluting.
"Tell me good news, Radiant Sigzil," Dalinar said. "Please."
"Stargyle?" Sigzil asked.
"Sure thing,"
Stargyle said, breathing in stormlight from a pouch at his belt. He began to paint with his fingers in the air.
Each of them did it differently. Shallan had explained that they each needed some kind of focus to make their surge binding work.
Hers was drawings. Stargyle appeared to have a different method, something more akin to painting. The light weaving created a view from above, surveying a shoreline landscape. An army camped along the shore, though it didn't have much discipline. Large groups of men around campfires, no real uniforms, a variety of weapons. Ishar's troops seemed to have good numbers, however, and they were well equipped. Their success on the battlefields in this region made Dalinar careful not to underestimate them. They might not have proper uniforms, but these were battle-hardened veterans.
"Here, Brightlord,"
Stargyle said, and the image began moving as if in real life.
"I can keep it all in my head so long as I focus on the colors."
"The colors?" Dalinar said.
"I was a pigmenter's son growing up, Brightlord. I've always seen the world by its colors. Squint your eyes a little and everything is really just color and shapes."
Dalinar inspected the moving illusion. It depicted the entire camp of people and, most interestingly, a large pavilion at the center. It was colored in ringed patterns like the bracelets he'd seen Tukari wear. He thought they had religious significance, though he didn't know much about the region. The Tukari were renowned for their mercenaries, their perfumes, and he believed their jewelry. The illusion rippled as Dalinar walked closer. A single person stood in front of the pavilion. He wasn't wearing the same clothing as the soldiers and wasn't holding a weapon.
"We get down closer in a second, sir," Sigzil said. "You should notice the person out front."
"I see him," Dalinar said, leaning forward.
Indeed, the image soon drew closer to the pavilion and the figure became more distinct. An older man. Didn't seem Tukari or Alethi.
"Yes.
He was probably Shin, which was what Wit had said Ishar would appear to be. An older Shin man with a white beard and pale skin. Tukar was named after Tuk, their word for the herald Talanelot. But it wasn't Taln who ruled them. Not now. It was a different herald. Ishar wore simple robes, deep blue. He spread his hands out to the sides, frost crystallizing on the stone around him, forming lines. A glyph, the symbol for mystery, a question. It seemed directed at Dalinar specifically. This was absolutely the right man. Dalinar didn't need to consult the drawings that Wit had provided. He heard a hiss from beside him and glanced with surprise to see that Zeth had left his post by the entrance to the tent. He'd joined Dalinar, standing very close to the illusion.
"One of my—"
Zeth stopped himself, likely remembering that he wore the image of an Alethi man.
"Blood of my fathers," he said instead. "That man is Shin?"
"Rather," Dalinar said, "he is from the people who long ago settled Shinovar and became the Shin. The heralds existed before our nationalities were formed." Zeth seemed transfixed, as if he'd never considered that one of the heralds might be Shin. Dalinar understood. He'd seen many depictions of all 10 heralds, and they were usually all painted as Alethi. You had to search the masterworks of earlier ages to find depictions of the heralds representing all the peoples of Roshar. The illusion moved on from Ishar as the Windrunners finished their sweep of the area, bringing Stargyle higher, safely out of bowshot. The light weaving disintegrated.
"That's all we saw, Bright Lord," Stargyle said. "I could show it again if you want."
"No need," Dalinar said. "We've found him. And he's waiting for me."
"Waiting for you, sir?"
Sigzil asked, glancing toward Lin and Leighton.
"Yes," Dalinar said. "Do another scouting mission and report back on what you find. I want to consult with Yasna first, but we're going to go meet that man, Radiant Sigzil, and find out what he knows."
99. Not Bound.
"I had my title and my rhythms stripped from me for daring insist they should not be killed, but should instead be reconditioned, repurposed."
Musings of El on the first of the final 10 days.
Yasna leaned back in her chair, lit by sphere light. The Spanreed report had just arrived. Today's conflict with the enemy armies had ended. The coalition forces had won. Emul was, essentially, now theirs. She still ached from her part in earlier battles, though she'd sat this one out. Dalinar had been there, and they didn't want to put both of them on the same battlefield at once. Regardless, this particular offensive being finished checked one thing off her list, but there was so much to do still with Urithiru in enemy hands. Her house here in their command camp was far nicer than the one Dalinar had picked for himself. She'd chosen it not for the luxury or for the space, but because it had a second floor. Locked away in a central room on the second level, sharing no walls with the outside, alone save for Wit's company, she could finally let herself relax. If a shard bearer broke in, or if a skybreaker came through one of the upper windows, her fabrial traps would go off, sounding the alarm and giving her time to fight or escape into Shadesmar before she could be killed. She had a boat waiting on the other side, as close to analogous to this location as Shadesmar would allow. She kept stores of stormlight in the pockets of her dressing gown, which she now wore. She would never again be caught unaware. She would never again be left struggling in Shadesmar without proper resources, forced to spend weeks hunting a perpendicularity. It was only with these preparations that Jasnah felt safe enough to let herself become frustrated. In her lifetime studying history, Jasnah had been guided by two principles. First, that she must cut through the biases of the historians in order to understand the past. Second, that only in understanding the past could she properly prepare for the future. She'd dedicated so much to this study, but a life's work could be shaken when history got up and started talking to you. She leafed through papers more valuable than the purest emerald, filled with her interviews with the heralds Ash and Taln, living history, people who had seen the events she'd read about. In essence, years of her life had been wasted. What good were her theories now? They were halfway reliable recreations of what might have happened, pieced together from fragments of different manuscripts. Well, now she could simply ask. The challenge of Stormhold? Oh, Ash had been there. King Iolid had been drunk. The Treaty of Four Nights? A delaying tactic intended to position the enemy for a betrayal. All those debates, and Jochi was right while Jasnah was wrong, settled as easily as that. Of course, there were things the heralds didn't know, things they wouldn't say, or, in Taln's case, things they couldn't say. Jasnah flipped through the pages, trying to piece together anything from her more recent interviews that would help with the situation at Urithiru. Even the heralds knew little of this sibling, the secretive Tower Spren. She needed to present this to the other Verestatalians, see what they could tease from it all. Yet the words of the heralds cast doubt on her second guiding principle, that the past was the best gauge of the future. There was another way. The enemy could see what would happen in the future. That terrified her. In relying on the past, Jasnah saw the future through occluded glass from within a chasm, if at all. Odium had a prime spot atop the watchtower. She sighed, and Wit unfolded himself from the chair snug in the corner on the other side of the room. He stretched, then wandered over and knelt beside her, before taking her unclothed safe hand and kissing the tip of the index finger. At that, Jasnah felt a little thrill of mystery. She'd come to realize, early in her youth, that she didn't approach relationships the same way everyone else seemed to. Her partners in the past had always complained that she was too cold, so academic. That had frustrated her. How was she to learn what others felt if she couldn't ask them? She didn't have that problem with Wit. He presented an entire world of other problems, but he never was bothered by her questions, even if he often dodged them. "My dear," he said, "you pay me no heed. Be careful not to give undue attention only to the ravings of the mad. I warn you, without proper affection, your wit will wilt." She removed her hand from his grip and studied him. Keen eyes, a nose that was perhaps a bit too sharp. Most women, she suspected, would find him physically attractive. And indeed, she appreciated his statuesque quality, with such interesting proportions and such an intense face. The nose humanized him, in her opinion, made him feel more real. Curiously, he wasn't a Lethe, but he had transformed himself to look like one. She'd been able to tease that much from him. He was something more ancient. He'd laughed when she'd asked, and said the Alethi hadn't existed when he'd been born, so he couldn't have been credited the honor of being one of her gifted people. She found the way he spoke fascinating. After all this time, and all her worries, here was one who was her intellectual equal, perhaps her superior. She didn't trust him, of course, but that was part of what intrigued her. "How do we beat him, Wit?" she asked softly. "If he can truly see the future, then what possible chance do we have?" "I once knew a man," Wit said, "who was the finest gambler in all his realm. Where he lived, you make your cards walk themselves around the table by breathing life into them. He was the best. Intelligent, skilled with the breath of life, a shrewd gambler. He knew exactly how to bet and when. Everyone was waiting for the day when he lost. And eventually he did." "That's different, Wit," Jasnah said. "He couldn't literally see the future." "Ah, but you see, I was rigging the games. So I did know the future, as much as Odium does anyway. I shouldn't have been able to lose, yet I did."
"How?"
"Someone else rigged the game, so that no matter what move I made, I could not win. The game was a tie, something I hadn't anticipated. I'd focused my cheating on making certain I didn't lose, but I'd bet on myself winning. And I bet it all, you see. If I'd have been more clever, I'd have let less be lost."
"So," she said, "how do we set it up so Odium doesn't win, even if he can't lose?"
Wit unfolded a paper from his pocket, still kneeling beside her. He seemed to genuinely like her, and she found his companionship invigorating, full of questions, delights, and surprises. She could provide the intimacy he desired, though she knew he found her lack of excitement on that axis odd, perhaps unsatisfying. That was not a new experience for her. She'd always found it curious how others put their physical urges ahead of the more powerful emotions of bonding, relating, and engaging. The chance to scheme, to connect with a being like Wit, that was exciting. She was curious how the relationship would develop, and that invigorated her. After so many failures, this was something new and interesting. She cupped his face with her hand. She wished she could deep down truly trust him. He was something she and this world had never before known. That was electrifying. It was also so extremely dangerous. Wit smiled at her, then smoothed out the paper on her writing desk. It was scribed in his own hand, of course. He came from a land where men had been encouraged to write, the same as women. He shot her a glance, then his smile became a grin. Yes, he did seem genuinely fond of their relationship, as much as she was. Indeed, he said it had taken him by surprise, as it had her. "A contract," she said, turning from him and reading the paper. "For Dalinar's contest with Odium." Wit had undoubtedly sculpted each word with precision. "If Dalinar wins, Odium retreats to damnation for 1,000 years. If Odium wins, he must remain in the system, but gets Roshar to do with as he pleases. The monarchs will submit to his rule, as will the Radiants who follow Dalinar."
"Perfect," Wit said. "Wouldn't you say?"
Jasnah sat back. "Perfect for you. If this is agreed to, you win no matter what. Odium remains contained in the Rosharan system either way." Wit spread his hands before himself.
"I've learned a few things since that challenge with the cards so many years ago. But Jasnah, this is for the best. If Dalinar wins, well, your people get what they want. But if Dalinar loses, Odium is contained. We're limiting our losses, making certain that at the boundaries of this planet, hell and hate must halt.
It puts everything on this one contest of champions, Jasnah said. I hate that tradition, even when played for lower stakes. Says the woman who used me in a ploy to manipulate that very tradition not 2 weeks ago. Lower stakes, Jasnah repeated, involving a meaningless loss such as your death. Jasnah! Wit, you're immortal, she said. You told me yourself. And you believed me? He asked, aghast. She paused and studied him. He grinned, then kissed her hand again. He seemed to think that sort of thing would eventually spark passion in her, when in truth, physical stimulation was so inferior to mental stimulation. I told you I haven't died when killed. Yet, he said. Doesn't mean someone won't find a way someday, and I'd rather not give them an opportunity. Besides, even for me, being killed can confound. Don't distract me, she said. Can we really risk the fate of the world on a simple duel? Ah, but it's not a duel, Jasnah. That's the thing. It's not about the contest, but what leads up to the contest. I know Reyes. He is arrogant and enjoys being worshipped. He never does anything without delighting in how he can show off. He's also careful, subtle. So to win, we need to make him certain he can't utterly lose. This contract does that. If his fail state is that he has to wait 1,000 years to try again, well, that won't bother him. He has been here for thousands of years already, so he'll see another 1,000 as an acceptable loss. But to you and the budding Radiance, 1,000 years is a long time, long as a soulless star slumbers. A soulless star, yes, slumbers, as they do. She stared at him flatly. Long as a rat rends rust? He asked. Long as seasons see stories? Oh, that's delightful, Jasnah. Pretend I was the one who could somehow stress said symphonian sounds. She cocked an eyebrow at him. It means beautiful, he said. No, it doesn't. She again studied the contract. Sometimes I feel you aren't taking this as seriously as you should, Wit. It's a personal failing, he said. The more serious something becomes, the more I find myself inappropriately involved. Indeedy. Jasnah sighed. I'll stop, he said with a grin, I promise. But look, Jasnah, Reyes, Odium, is someone we can defeat. If he has one great failing, it's that he thinks he's smarter than he is. He tried exceptionally hard to make Dalinar into his champion. Why? Because he doesn't merely want to win. He wants to win in a way that says something to everyone watching. He was so certain he could turn the Blackthorn that he bet almost everything on that singular gamble. Now, he must be scared. While he pretends he has 12 other plans, he's scrambling to locate a champion who can legitimately win. Because he knows, same as I'm telling you, that the contest won't only be about who can stab the hardest with their spear. What will it be about, then? Same thing it's always about, Jasnah, Wit said. The hearts of men and women. Do you trust the hearts of those who fight on your side? She paused and hoped he didn't read too much into it. Staring at the contract, she couldn't help but feel outmatched by all of this. She, who had been preparing for nearly 2 decades for these exact events, felt uncertain. Did she trust her own heart when confronted with ancient troubles that had surely defeated better women than her? A wise answer, Wit whispered. I didn't give one. A wise answer. He squeezed her hand. If you give Odium this contract and get me the assurance that he cannot break free of this planetary system, no matter what happens, Then you won't have to trust the hearts of mortals, Jasnah. Because you'll have me, and everything I can give you. You've told me he would destroy you if he found you. We'll add a line to the contract, Wit said, naming me as a contractual liaison for honor, whom Dalinar represents. This will protect me from Odium's direct attacks for the life of the contract. He will have to abide by those terms, as they are part of the promise Reyes made by taking up the Shard of Odium. To fail that promise would give others an opening against him, and said failures have killed gods before. Odium knows it. So do this, and I can help you openly, as myself. And who is that, Wit? She asked. Who are you, really? Someone, he said, who wisely turned down the power the others all took, and in so doing, gained freedoms they can never again have. I, Jasnah, am someone who is not bound. She met his eyes, the eyes of something that wasn't a man, a thing that was eternal as a spren, or, if he was to be believed, something even older. I feel, she said, like I should be terrified by that statement. That's why I'm so fond of you, he said. You are poised, you are smart, and you are always ready with a ploy. But when each of those things fails you, Jasnah, you are, above all else, paranoid.
100. Watchers at the Rim.
Humans are weapons. We singers revere passion, do we not? How can we throw away such an excellent channeling of it?
Musings of El on the first of the final 10 days. Kaladin woke with a start, ready to fight. He struggled, his heart racing as he found his hands bound. Why? What was happening? He grunted, thrashing in the darkness, and he started to remember. He'd tied his hands together on purpose to prevent him from punching someone who woke him like he'd done to Dabid yesterday. He gasped, fighting the terror as he huddled against the wall. Kaladin told himself the visions were only nightmares, but he still wanted to claw at his own skull, burrow into it, pull out all the terrible thoughts, the overwhelming darkness. Storms. He was so tired. Eventually, he managed to calm himself enough to free his hands. He searched around the black chamber but saw nothing. They hadn't left out any lights. Teft, however, was snoring softly. Everything was all right. Kaladin was all right. He fumbled around his mat, looking for the canteen he'd placed there when going to sleep. What had awakened him? He remembered a song, a distant song. He found the canteen, but then saw a light on the wall, faint, almost invisible, even in the darkness. Hesitant, he wiped the sweat from his brow, then reached out and touched the garnet. A voice, so very quiet, spoke in his mind. Help. Please. Storms, the tower spren sounded frail. What is wrong? They found the last note?
Yes. At the model.
The model? Kaladin frowned, then remembered the large model of the tower in the infirmary room. In there? Near the Radiance? Storms. That's where his parents were.
There is something else. So much worse.
What? Kaladin demanded. What could be worse?
They will soon kill all the Radiance.
The Radiance? Kaladin said. The captive ones?
Please send me Relaine.
The voice faded along with the light. Kaladin took a deep breath, trembling. Could he do this again? He took out a sphere, then woke Teft. The other bridgeman came awake, grabbing Kaladin by the arm reflexively. His grip was weak. Despite what he said, the time in a coma had left him enervated.
I have to fight, Kaladin thought. I'm the only one who can.
What is it? Teft said.
Something's happening, Kaladin said. The tower's Spren woke me, saying the final node has been located. The sibling told me the Radiants are in danger and asked me to send Relaine. I think they meant to send Relaine to Navani like we'd been planning. Our hand seems to have been forced. We need to try to rescue the Radiants.
Teft nodded, groaning as he sat up.
You don't seem surprised, Kaladin said.
I'm not, Teft said, heaving himself to his feet. This was coming, lad, no matter what we did. I'm sorry. Doesn't seem we have time to do it your father's way.
Watchers at the rim, Kaladin said softly. We need to move quickly. You get Lift ready to sneak into the Radiance so she can begin waking them up. I'll make a fuss outside to lure out the guards and distract the pursuer. If the guards don't come out, though, you'll have to neutralize them.
All right, then. Good enough.
Teft pointed to the side, to where something lay folded on the ground. Bridge 4 uniforms. Kaladin had asked Dabba to get them changes of clothing. That was what he'd found? As they began to dress, Dabbid returned, frantic. He came up and grabbed Kaladin's arm.
The Tower Spren talked to you too? Kaladin asked.
Dabbid nodded.
They sounded so weak.
Do you know where Relaine is?
Kaladin asked.
I'm going to meet him, Dabbid said. Fourth floor. Something's happened with Venli that has him really shaken. He didn't want to talk in the infirmary.
Tell him the plan is a go, Kaladin said. Someone needs to inform the Queen. Do you think you two can get to her?
Relaine thinks he can, Dabbid said. I will go with him. People ignore me.
Go then, Kaladin said. Tell her what we're doing, and that we're going to have to get the Radiance out. Then you two take up hiding in this room and don't make any storms. We'll escape with the Radiance, get Dalinar in return for you.
Dabbid wrung his hands, but nodded.
Bridge 4, he whispered.
Bridge 4, Kaladin said.
I don't want to leave you two alone, Dabbid, but we need to move now, and I want the Queen to be contacted. Plus, the sibling said something about sending Relaine to them.
They said it to me too, Dabbid said.
He gave the salute, which Kaladin returned, then moved off at a run. If something goes wrong, Kaladin said to Teft, continuing to dress in his uniform, get out that window. They'd practiced Kaladin's trick of infusing objects and his boots to climb down walls. In an emergency, someone might have to jump out the window and hope to regain their powers before they hit the ground, but that was an absolute last resort. The current plan was for the Windrunners to climb down the outside, each with another Radiant strapped to their backs. It was far from a perfect plan, but it was better than letting the Fused murder the Radiants while they were in comas. Even if you only get yourself out, Kaladin said, do it, rather than staying and making a hopeless stand. Take your Spren and get to Dalinar.
And you? Teft said. You'll follow, right?
Kaladin hesitated.
If I run, you run, Teft said. Look, what happened the last two times a node was discovered?
The pursuer was waiting for me, Kaladin admitted.
He will be again, Teft said. This is a trap, plain and simple. What the enemy doesn't know is that we don't care about the node. We're trying to free the Radiance. So distract him a little, yes, but then run and let them have their storming fabrile.
I could try that.
Give me an oath, lad. We can't do anything more in this tower. We need to reach Dalinar. I'm going to head that way with as many Radiants as I can rescue. You've got my back, right?
Always, Kaladin said, nodding. I swear it.
Get as many of the Radiants out as you can and then run. Once you do, I'll follow. 101. Undertext.
I love their art. The way they depict us is divine. All red shades and black lines. We appear demonic and fearsome, They project all fear and terror upon us.
Musings of L on the first of the final 10 days. Dalinar stepped into the Prime's war camp home and immediately felt as if he'd entered the wrong building. Surely this was a storage room where they were keeping extra furniture gathered from the surrounding abandoned towns. But no, Dalinar was merely accustomed to austerity. It was an Alethi wartime virtue for a commander to eschew comfort. Dalinar had perhaps taken this idea too far on occasion, but he'd become comfortable with simple furniture, bare walls. Even his rooms in Urethiru had grown too cluttered for his taste. Young Yanagon came from a different tradition. This entry room was so full of rich furniture, painted bronze on every surface that wasn't of some plush material, that it created a maze Dalinar had to wind through to reach the other side. Adding to the difficulty, the room was also packed with a battalion's worth of servants. Twice Dalinar encountered someone in bright Asian patterns who had to physically climb onto a couch to let him pass. Where had they found all of this? And those tapestries draping every visible space on the walls? Had they carried them all this way? He knew the Azish were more accustomed to long supply chains. They didn't have access to the number of food-making soul casters that the Alethi did. But this was excessive, wasn't it? Though, he noted, turning back across the room as he reached the other side, this would certainly slow an assassin or a force who tried to break in here and attack the Prime. In the next room, he found an even greater oddity. The Prime, Yanagon the First, Emperor of Makabak, sat in a throne at the head of a long table. Nobody else ate at the table, but it was stuffed with lit candelabras and plates of food. Yanagon was finishing his breakfast, mostly pre-cut fruit. He wore a mantle of heavy cloth and an ornate headdress. He ate primly, spearing each bite of fruit with a long skewer, then raising it to his lips. He barely seemed to move, with one hand held crossed before his chest as he manipulated the skewer with the other. A large rank of people stood to either side of him. They mostly seemed to be camp followers, washwomen, wheelwrights, reshi chul keepers, seamstresses. Dalinar picked out only a few uniforms. Yasna had already arrived for the meeting. She stood among the groups of people, and a servant ushered Dalinar in that direction as well, so he joined the bizarre display. Standing and watching the Emperor eat his fruit, one delicate bite at a time. Dalinar liked the Azish, and they'd proven to be good allies with a shockingly effective military. But storms above and damnation beyond were they strange. Although curiously, he found their excess to be less nauseating than when an Alethi high prince indulged. In Alethkar, this would be an expression of arrogance and a lack of self-restraint. Here, there was a certain cohesion to the display. Alethi servants of the highest order wore simple black and white, but the Azish ones were dressed almost as richly as the Emperor. The overflowing table didn't seem to be for Yanagon. He was merely another ornament. This was about the position of Prime, and the Empire itself, more than an elevation of the individual man. From what Dalinar had heard, they'd had trouble appointing this most recent Prime. The reason for that was, of course, standing directly behind Dalinar, Zeth, the assassin in white, had killed the last two Primes. At the same time, Dalinar couldn't imagine anyone wanting to be Prime. They had to deal with all this pomp, always on display. Maybe that was why their scholarly republic worked in a way Yasna liked so much. They had accidentally made the position of emperor so awful no sane person would want it. So they'd needed to find other ways to rule the country. Dalinar had learned enough social grace to remain quiet until the display was complete. Each of the onlookers was then given a bronze plate full of food, which they accepted after bowing to the emperor. As they left, one by one, Other servants quickly made space at the table for Jasnah and Dalinar, though the clock he wore in his arm bracer told him he was still a few minutes early for the meeting. Damnation's own device, that was. Had him hopping about like the prime. Though admittedly, Dalinar was realizing how much less of his time was wasted now that everyone knew precisely when to meet together. Without ever saying a word, Navani was bringing order to his life.
Be safe, please, my life's light, my gem heart.
He sent Zeth out, as neither of the other two monarchs had guards in the room. As they settled, the last of the observers leaving, Nura bowed to the prime, then took a seat at the table deliberately positioned to be lower than the three of them. Some in the Empire considered it a scandal that Dalinar, Jasnah, and Fenn were always seated at the same height as the prime, but Yanagon had insisted. Dalinar, Jasnah, the youth said, relaxing as he removed his headdress and set it onto the table. Nura gave him a glance at that, but Dalinar smiled. She obviously thought the prime should maintain decorum, but Dalinar liked seeing the youth grow more comfortable with his position and his fellow monarchs.
I'm sorry we didn't have plates of food for you as well, Yanagon continued in Azish. I should have known you'd both arrive early.
It would have made a fine memento, Majesty, Jasnah said, laying out some papers on the table. But we were not of the chosen today, so it wouldn't feel right to be so favored.
The boy looked to Nura.
I told you she understood.
Your wisdom grows, Imperial Majesty, the older woman said.
She was an Azish vizier, a high-level civil servant. Her own outfit had less gold on it than the prime's, but it was nevertheless fantastically colored, with a cap and contrasting coat of a multitude of patterns and hues. Her long hair was graying and wound into a braid that emerged from her cap on one side.
All right, Jasnah,
Yanagon said, leaning forward to inspect Jasnah's papers, though as far as Dalinar knew, he couldn't read Alethi.
Tell it to me straight.
Dalinar braced himself.
We have practically no chance of recovering Eurythiru, Jasnah said in Azish, her voice barely accented. Our scouts confirm that Fabrials don't work near it. That means if we were to recreate a smaller version of my mother's flying machine to deliver troops, it would drop the moment it drew close. They've also blocked off the caverns. My uncle delivered a small force to the bottom, and that action seems to have informed the enemy that we know their ruse is up. They are no longer sending fake messages via Spanreed, and we've seen Singer troops on the balconies. With a shard blade, which we discovered can be delivered into the protected area so long as it is not bound, our troops can cut through the blockage at the bottom. But while doing that, the force would be exposed to archers on higher ground. And if we made it through that rubble, fighting all the way up through a contested tunnel system would be a nightmare. A march by soldiers along the tops of the mountains is impossible for a multitude of reasons. But if we did reach the tower, we'd lose. Our battlefields are a careful balance of radiant against fused, shardbearer against regal, soldier against soldier. At Eurythiru, we'd have no radiance, and the entire strategy would topple.
We'd have Kaladin, Dalinar said. His powers still work. The Stormfather thinks it's because he's far enough along in his oaths.
With all due respect to him, Jasnah said, Kaladin is just one man, and one you relieved of duty before we left.
She was correct, of course. Common sense dictated that one man was nothing against an army of fused. Yet Dalinar wondered. Once, in the war camps, he'd argued with Kaladin's soldiers who had set up a vigil for the young Windrunner, then presumed dead. Dalinar had been proven wrong that time. Now he found himself possessing some of the same faith as those soldiers. Beaten down, broken, surrounded by enemies, Kaladin continued to fight. He knew how to take the next step. They couldn't leave him to take it alone.
Our best chance, Dalinar said to the others, is to deliver me and a force through Shadesmar to the tower. I might be able to open a perpendicularity there, and we could surprise the enemy with an attack.
You might,
be able to open one there, uncle, Yasna said. What does the Stormfather think?
He isn't certain I am far enough along in my oaths or my skills to manage it yet, Delanor admitted.
Yasna tapped her notes.
An assault through Shadesmar would require a large number of ships, something we don't have on that side, and which I see no way of obtaining.
We need to find a way to support Caladan, Avani, and whatever resistance they are building, Delanor said. We might not need a large force of ships. A small group of trained soldiers might be able to sneak in, then disable the fabrial the enemy is using to stop Radiance.
Undoubtedly, Yasna said. That is the method the enemy used to get into the tower. They will be guarding against this same tactic.
So what? Yanagon said, chewing on some nuts he had hidden in a pocket of his oversized robes.
Yasna, you argue against every point Delanor makes. Are you saying we should give up Urethiru to the enemy?
Our entire war effort falls apart without it, Nora said. It was the means by which we connected our disparate forces.
Not necessarily, Yasna said, showing some small maps to the Prime. As long as we have a stronger navy and proper air support, we can control the southern half of Roshar. It will necessitate weeks or months of travel, but we can coordinate our battlefields as long as we have span rates.
Still, Yanagon said, glancing at Nora. The older woman nodded in agreement.
This is a major blow, Delanor said. Yasna, we can't simply abandon Urethiru. You yourself spent years trying to locate it.
I'm not suggesting we do, uncle, she said, her voice cold. I'm merely presenting facts. For now, I think we need to act as if we will not soon retake the tower, which might mean moving against Ishar's troops in Tukar, so we can secure those positions. At any rate, we should be planning how to support our forces in southern Alethkar against the Vadens.
They were all valid points, the core of a cohesive and well-reasoned battle strategy. She was trying hard, and mostly succeeding, at learning to be a capable tactical commander. He couldn't blame her for feeling she had something to prove there. Her entire life had been a series of people demanding she prove herself to them. However, her quickness to abandon Urethiru smelled too similar to what Taravangian had done in abandoning Roshar. Give up quickly, once you think you're beaten.
Yasna, he said, we need to try harder to liberate Urethiru.
I'm not saying we shouldn't, only that such an action is going to be very difficult and costly. I'm trying to outline those costs so we're aware of them.
The way you talk lacks hope.
Hope, she said, spreading her papers out on the table. Have I ever told you how much I dislike that word? Think of what it means, what it implies. You have hope when you're outnumbered. You have hope when you lack options. Hope is always irrational, uncle.
Fortunately, we are not entirely rational beings.
Nor should we want to be, she agreed. At the same time, how often has hope been the reason someone refuses to move on and accept a realistic attitude? How often has hope caused more pain or delayed healing? How often has hope prevented someone from standing up and doing what needs to be done because they cling to a wish for everything to be different?
I would say, Yanagon said, leaning forward,
that hope defines us, Yasna. Without it, we are not human.
Perhaps you are correct, Yasna said, a phrase she often used when she wasn't convinced, but also didn't want to continue an argument.
Very well, then, let us discuss Urethiru.
Your powers will work, Delanor said, at least partially. You have said the fourth ideal.
Yes, she said, I have, though the Stormfather is uncertain whether the Fourth Oath will truly allow a Radiant to withstand the suppression. Am I correct?
You are, Delanor said. But if the enemy is resupplying via the Oath Gates, there is only one way we can realistically do anything about this situation. We must destroy their suppression fabrial. and so my suggestion of a small team makes the most sense.
And you are to lead it? Jasna said.
Yes, Dalinar said.
You are still far from mastering your powers. What if you can't open a perpendicularity at Urethiru?
I've been experimenting, practicing, Dalinar said. But yes, I've a long way to go. So I've been considering another solution.
He selected one of Jasna's maps, then turned it for the others to see.
We came here to Emil to use a hammer and anvil tactic, shoving our enemy against an army here, the army of Ishar, the being the Azish call Tashi.
Yes, and? Jasna asked.
I have scouts surveying his position, Dalinar said, and have visual confirmation shown to me via light weaving that the man himself is there. Witt's drawings confirm it. I have spoken with the Stormfather, and the two of us think this is our best solution. Ishar is a master with the bondsmithing art. If I can recruit him, he could be the secret to saving Urethiru.
Pardon, Nora said, but haven't we determined that the Heralds are all insane?
It was hard for her to say. Their religion viewed the Heralds as deities. The Makabaki people worshipped them and not the Almighty.
Yes, Dalinar said, but Ash indicates Ishar might have escaped with less damage than others. She trusts him.
We've had letters from Ishar, Uncle, Jasna said, that are not encouraging.
I want to try speaking with him anyway, Dalinar said. We've been mostly ignoring his armies, other than to use them as our anvil. But if I were to approach with a flag of peace and parley, Ishar...
Wait, Yanagon said. You're going to go personally?
Yes, Dalinar said. I need to see Ishar. Ask him questions.
Send your radiance, Nora said. Take this being captive. Bring him here. Then talk to him.
I would rather go myself, Dalinar said.
But,
Yanagon said, sounding utterly baffled,
you're a king. This is even worse than when Jasna went out in plate and fought the enemy.
It's an old family tradition, Majesty, Jasna said. We are prone to putting ourselves into the thick of things. I blame long-standing Alethi conditioning that says the best general is the one who leads the charge.
I suppose, Yanagon said, that a history of having excessive numbers of shards might create a feeling of invincibility. But Dalinar, why do you raise this point now? To get our advice?
More to warn you, he said. I've deliberately put the Mink in command of our military so I can step away to see to more spiritual matters. Jasna and Witt are preparing a contract for me to present to Odium once we have pushed him to come speak to me again. Until we can make that work, I need to do something to help. I need to bring Ishar to our side, then see if he can teach me how to restore the Oath Pact and help me rescue Urethiru.
Well,
Yanagon said, looking to Nora,
being allies with the Alethi is interesting. Go with Ysir's own speed, then, I suppose.
Ysir is dead, Dalinar thought, though he didn't say it.
Jasna took the reins of the conversation next, explaining the contract she was preparing for Odium. She and Dalinar had already talked to Queen Fen earlier via Spanreed. Dalinar offered some explanations, but mostly let Jasna do the persuading. She had an uphill battle, as getting the monarchs to agree to this contest would take some doing. Jasna could manage it. He was confident in her. His job, he was increasingly certain, involved his bondsmithing, the Oath Pact, and the Heralds. Eventually, the meeting came to an end. They agreed to meet again to talk over more points in the contract, but for now, Yanagon had to attend some religious ceremonies for his people. Dalinar needed to prepare for his trip to Tukar. He intended to go as soon as was reasonable. As they rose to leave, Yanagon replaced his headdress.
Dalinar, the youth said, do we know anything of Lift? We left her at the tower.
Kaladin said the other Radiants were unconscious, Dalinar said,
That probably includes her.
Maybe, Yanagon said. She often does what she isn't supposed to. If you hear word, send to me, please.
Dalinar nodded, joining Jasnah and withdrawing from Yanagon's palace. The exterior might look as ordinary as every other building in the village, but a palace it was. He collected Zeth, who was holding something for him. Dalinar took the large book, intimidating in size, though he knew it to be shorter than it appeared. The paper inside was covered with his own bulky letter lines, larger and thicker than was proper, drawn deliberately with his fat fingers. He held the book toward Jasnah. He'd allowed early drafts and portions of it to be shared, and they'd gotten out all over the coalition by now. However, he hadn't considered the book finished until he'd made some last changes earlier this week.
Oathbringer, she said, taking it eagerly. It's complete?
No, but my part is done, Dalinar said. This is the original, though the scribes have made copies following my last round of alterations. I wanted you to have the one I wrote.
You should feel proud, Uncle. You make history with this volume.
I fear you'll find it to be mostly religious drivel.
Ideas are not useless simply because they involve religious thinking, Jasnah said. Nearly all of the ancient scholars I revere were religious, and I appreciate how their faith shaped them, even if I do not appreciate the faith itself.
The things you said about hope in the meeting, Dalinar said. They bothered me, Jasnah. But perhaps in a good way. Who in the world would dispute an idea as fundamental as hope? Yet because we all accept it as vital, we don't think about it, what it really means. You do.
I try, she said, glancing back toward the Prime's palace. Tell me, am I pushing too hard to establish myself as a military leader? I feel it's an important precedent, as your book here is, but I hit the target a little too squarely, didn't I?
Dalinar smiled, then put his hand on hers, which held up the book.
We are revealing a new world, Jasnah, and the way before us is dark until we bring it light. We'll be forgiven if we stumble on unseen ground now and then.
He squeezed her hand.
I would like you to do something for me. All of the great philosophical texts I've read have an undertext. Yes, about that.
He wasn't the only man who had been shaken to discover that for centuries the women in their lives had been leaving commentaries for one another. Something dictated by a man would often have his wife's or scribe's thoughts underneath, never shared aloud. An entire world hidden from those who thought they were ruling it.
I would like you to write the undertext for Oathbringer, Dalinar said. Openly. To be read and discovered by any who would like to read it.
Uncle, Jasnah said, I'm not certain the tradition should continue. It was questionable to begin with.
I find the insights offered in the undertexts to be essential, Dalinar said. They change how I read. History is written by the victors, as many are fond of saying, but at least we have contrary insights by those who watched. I would like to know what you think of what I've said.
I will not hold back, Uncle, Jasnah said. If much of this is religious, I will be compelled to be honest. I will point out your confirmation biases, your fallacies. Perhaps it would be better if you gave the undertext task to my mother.
I considered that, he said, but I promised to unite instead of divide. I don't do that by giving my book only to those who agree with me. If we're revealing a new world, Jasnah, should we not do it together? Arguments and all? I feel like we are never going to agree on the details, you and I. This book, though, it could show that we agree on the more important matters. After all, if an avowed atheist and a man starting his own religion can unite, then who can object that their personal differences are too large to surmount?
That's what you're doing, then? She asked. Creating a religion?
Revising the old one, at the very least, Dalinar said. When the full text of this is released, I suspect it will create a larger schism among Vornism.
Me being involved won't help that.
I want your thoughts nonetheless, if you are willing to give them.
She pulled the book close. I consider it among the greatest honors I have ever been offered, Uncle. Be warned, however, I am not known for my brevity. This could take me years. I will be thorough, I will offer counterpoints, and I may undermine your entire argument. But I will be respectful.
Whatever you need, Jasna.
He smiled.
I hope that in your additions we will create something greater than I could have alone.
She smiled back. Don't say it that way. You make it sound like the odds are against it being possible, or I should say that it is the most reasonable outcome. Thank you, Uncle, for your trust.
102. High storm coming.
To humans, our very visages become symbols. You find echoes of it even in the art from centuries before this return.
Musings of El on the first of the final 10 days.
There was a long line at the oath gates today, but that was nothing new. Raboniel was certain the human kingdoms knew of the occupation by now, and so had authorized the oath gates to be opened more frequently, allowing singer troops and servants occupying the tower to rotate out. Then Lee's group of 15 friends huddled behind her, holding their supplies, hopefully appearing to be merely another batch of workers given a chance to return to Kolinar for a break. Venli pulled her coat tight against the wind. Listeners didn't get as cold as humans seemed to, but she could still feel the bite of the wind, particularly since this form had carapace only as ornamentation, not true armor. She wasn't completely certain what to do after reaching Kolinar. Raboniel's writ would certainly get her people out of the city, and even out of Alethkar. But Venli couldn't wait the weeks or months it would take for them to walk to the Shattered Plains. She had to find out if her mother was still alive. How far would the power of the writ go? Raboniel was feared, respected. Could Venli get her entire team of 15 flown to that scout post via Heavenly One? Her mind spun with lies about a secret mission from Raboniel at the Shattered Plains. Indeed, it wasn't too far from the truth. Raboniel had all but commanded her to go investigate the listener remnants. And what then? Venli thought. Raboniel knows about them. She knows I'm going. She's manipulating me. For what end? It didn't matter. Venli had to go. It was time. Timber pulsed softly as she stood in the line, map case over her shoulder, trying to ignore the wind. Are you disappointed in me? Venli whispered to Conceit. For leaving Relaine and the humans? Timber pulsed. Yes, she was. The little Spren was never afraid to be straight with Venli. What do you expect me to do? She whispered, turning her head away from Dull so he wouldn't hear her talking. Help with their insane plan? He'll get all those Radiants killed. Besides, you think I'd be any help to them? Timber pulsed. Venli was doing well, learning. She could help. If I weren't a coward, Venli thought. What if we got you a different host? A singer who cares, like Relaine? Timber pulsed. What do you mean? Venli demanded. You can't want me. I'm an accident, a mistake. Another pulse. Mistakes can't be wonderful, Timber. That's what defines them as mistakes. She pulsed, more confident. How could she be more confident with each complaint? Stupid Spren. And why wasn't this line moving? The transfers should be quick. They needed to exchange people and supplies before the high storm arrived. Venli told her people to wait, then stepped out of line. She marched to the front, where a couple of singers, formerly Azish by their clothing, were arguing. "What is it?" Venli demanded to Craving. The two took in her regal form, then the female one answered. "We have to wait to perform the exchange chosen," she said, using an old formal singer term. "The human who works the oath gates for us has run off. No one else has a living blade, which is needed to operate the fabrial now," the other explained. "If you could find the one they call Vire and ask when he will return." Venli glanced toward the sky. She could feel the wind picking up. "The high storm is nearly here. We should move everyone inside." The two argued at first, but Venli spoke more firmly. Soon they started herding the frustrated singers toward the tower. Venli walked along the plateau, timber pulsing excitedly. She saw this as an opportunity. "Why do you believe in me?" Venli whispered. "I've given you no reason. I've ruined everything I've touched. I'm a selfish, impotent, sorry excuse for a listener." Timber pulsed. Venli had saved her. Venli had saved Lift. "Yes, but I had to be coaxed into both," Venli said. "I'm not a hero. I'm an accident." Timber was firm. Some people charged toward the goal, running for all they had. Others stumbled. But it wasn't the speed that mattered. It was the direction they were going. Venli lingered at the entrance to Urethiru. She hesitated, glancing over her shoulder. The previous high storm had reached all the way past the sixth tier. This one would likely envelop nearly the entire tower. A rare occurrence, their scholars thought. She felt as if she could sense the power of it, the fury bearing down on them. "What if," she whispered to Timber, "I offered to use this writ to smuggle Stormblessed or his family out of Urethiru?" Timber pulsed uncertainly. Would the writ's authority extend that far? Venli thought perhaps it would. She wouldn't be able to get any of the unconscious radiants out. They were too closely watched. And someone would send to Raboniel for confirmation. But a few random humans? That might work. She found Dull and the others inside the front doors. Venli gathered them around, away from prying ears, and quickly handed her writ to Mazish. "Take this," Venli said. "If I don't return, you should be able to use it to get away." "Without you?" Mazish said. "Venli, I'll almost certainly return," Venli said. "But just in case, take the map too. You'll need it to find your way to the other listeners in secret."
"Where are you going?" Dull asked.
Venli hummed to the lost. "I think we should offer to bring the surgeon and his family, including their son the Windrunner, out with us. Help them escape the tower. Take them to their own people at the Shattered Plains." She watched them, expecting fear. Perhaps condemnation. This would jeopardize their safety. Instead, as a group, they hummed to consideration.
"Having a Windrunner on our side could be useful," Mazish said. "He could certainly help us get to the Shattered Plains quicker."
"Yes," said Schumann, the new recruit, still a little too eager for Venli's taste. "This is a great idea."
"Would he help us, though?" Dull asked.
"He treated Relaine well," Mazish said, "even when he thought Relaine was only another parchment. I don't like what the humans did, but if we put this one in our debt, my gut says he won't betray us." Venli scanned the other faces. Singers with a variety of skin patterns, now humming a variety of rhythms. None of them hummed to betrayal, and they gave her encouraging nods.
"Very well," Venli said. "Wait for me until the storm has passed. If I've not returned by then, take the next Oathgate transfer to Kolinar. I'll find you there."
They hummed at her words, so Venli started toward the atrium, hoping she'd be quick enough to stop Relaine from trying his desperate plan. She didn't know for certain if he'd take her offer, but this was the direction she should be moving. Navani knelt on the floor of her office. It still smelled of smoke from the explosion the day before. Despite Raboniel saying she wanted to scrape the chamber for broken pieces of the dagger, no one arrived to do that. They hadn't taken her to her rooms above. They hadn't brought her meals. They'd simply left her alone to contemplate her utter failure. She felt numb. After her previous failure, when she'd exposed the node to her enemies, she'd picked herself up and moved on. This time, she felt stuck, worn, like an old banner left too long exposed to the elements, ripped by storms, bleached by the sun, now hanging in tatters, waiting to slip off the pole. We can kill Radiant Spren. In the end, all Raboniel's talk of working together had been a lie. Of course it had. Navani had known it would be. She'd planned for it and tried to hide what she knew. But had she really expected that to work? She'd repeatedly confirmed to herself that she couldn't outthink the fused. They were ancient, capable beyond mortal understanding, beings outside of time and she kept staring at the place where Raboniel's daughter had died, where Raboniel had wept, holding the corpse of her child. Such a human moment. Navani curled up on her pallet, though sleep had eluded her all night. She had spent the hours listening to the fused in the hallway, playing notes on metal plates, and demanding new ones, until one final sound had echoed against the stone hallways. A chilling, awful sound that was wrong in all the right ways. Raboniel had found the tone. The tone that could kill Spren. Should Navani feel pride? Even in that time of near madness, her research had been so meticulous and well annotated that Raboniel was able to follow it. What had taken Navani days, the fused replicated in hours, breaking open a mystery that had stood for thousands of years. Evidence that Navani was a true scholar, after all? No, she thought, staring at the ceiling. No, don't you dare take that distinction for yourself. If she'd been a scholar, she'd have understood the implications of her work. She was a child playing dress-up again. A farmer could stumble across a new plant in the wilderness. Did that make him a botanist? She eventually forced herself up to do the only thing she was certain she couldn't ruin. She found ink and paper in the wreckage of the room, then knelt and began to paint prayers. It was partially for the comfort of familiarity, but storm her, she still believed. Perhaps that was as foolish as thinking herself a scholar. Who did she think was listening? Was she only praying because she was afraid? Yes, she thought, continuing to paint. I'm afraid. And I have to hope that someone somewhere is listening. That someone has a plan. That it all matters somehow. Jasna took comfort in the idea that there was no plan. That everything was random. She said that a chaotic universe meant the only actions of actual importance were the ones they decided were important. That gave people autonomy. Navani loved her daughter, but couldn't see it the same way. Organization and order existed in the very way the world worked, from the patterns on leaves to the system of compounds and chemical reactions. It all whispered to her. Someone had known anti-void light was possible. Someone had known Navani would create it first. Someone had seen all this, planned for it, and put her here. She had to believe that. She had to believe, therefore, that there was a way out. Please, she prayed, painting the glyph for divine direction. Please, I'm trying so hard to do what is right. Please guide me. What do I do? A voice sounded outside the room, and in her sleep-deprived state, she first mistook it for a voice speaking to her in answer. And then she heard what it was saying.
"The best way to distract the bondsmith is to kill his wife," the voice said, rough, cold. "I am therefore here to perform the act that you have so far refused to do."
Navani stood and walked to the door. Her female in guard was someone new, but she didn't forbid Navani from peering down the hall toward Raboniel's workstation beside the sibling's shield. A man in a black uniform stood before Raboniel, neat, close-cropped black hair, a narrow, hawkish face, with a prominent nose and sunken cheeks. Moash, the murderer.
"I continue to have use for the queen," Raboniel said. "My orders are from Odium himself," Moash said.
If a fused's voice was overly ornamented with rhythms and meaning, his voice was the opposite, dead, a voice like slate.
"He ordered you to come to me, Vire," Raboniel said, "and I requested for you to be sent. So today, I need you to deal with my problems first. There is a worm in the tower, eating his way through walls. He is increasingly an issue."
"I warned you about Stormblessed," Moash said.
"I warned all of you, and you did not listen."
"You will kill him," Raboniel said.
"No enemy can kill Kaladin Stormblessed," Moash said.
"You promised that
no enemy can kill Stormblessed," Moash said. "He is a force like the storms, and you cannot kill the storms, Fused."
Raboniel handed Moash something. A small dagger.
"You speak foolishness. A man is merely a man, no matter how skilled. That dagger can destroy his spren. Spread that sand, and it will turn faintly white when an invisible spren flies overhead. Use it to locate his honor spren, then strike at it, depriving him of power."
"I can't kill him," Moash repeated a third time, tucking the dagger away. "But I promise something better. We make this a covenant, Fused. I ruin Stormblessed, leave him unable to interfere, and you deliver me the queen. Accepted?"
Navani felt herself grow cold. Raboniel didn't even glance in her direction.
"Accepted," Raboniel said. "But do another thing for me. The pursuer has been sent to destroy the final node, but I think he is delaying to encourage Stormblessed to show up and fight him for it. Break the node for me."
Moash nodded and accepted what seemed to be a small diagram explaining the location of the node. He turned on his heel with military precision and marched up the hallway. If he saw her, he made no comment, passing like a cold wind.
"Monster," Navani said, anger spren at her feet. "Traitor! You would attack your own friend?"
He stopped short. Staring straight ahead, he spoke.
"Where were you, Light Eyes, when your son condemned innocence to death?"
He turned, affixing Navani with those lifeless eyes.
"Where were you, Queen, when your son sent Roshon to Kaladin's hometown, a political outcast, a known murderer, exiled to a small village where he couldn't do any damage, right? Roshon killed Kaladin's brother. You could have stopped it, if any of you cared. You were never my queen. You are nothing to me. You are nothing to anyone. So don't speak to me of treason or friendship. You have no idea what this day will cost me."
He continued forward, bearing no visible weapon save the dagger tucked into his belt. A dagger designed to kill a spren, a dagger that Navani had essentially created. He reached the end of the hallway, burst alight with stormlight,
which somehow worked for him, and streaked into the air, rising through the open stairwell toward the ground floor. Navani slumped in the doorway, objections withering in her throat. She knew he was wrong, but she couldn't find her voice. Something about that man unnerved her to the point of panic. He wasn't human. He was a void bringer. If that word had ever applied to any, it was Moash.
"What do you need?"
her guard asked.
"Have you been fed?"
Navani licked her lips. "I need a candle, please, for burning prayers." Remarkably, she fetched it. Taking the candle, shivering, Navani cupped the flame and walked to her pallet. There she knelt and began burning her glyph words, one at a time. If there was a god, if the Almighty was still out there somewhere, had he created Moash? Why? Why bring such a thing into the world? "Please," she thought, begging as a ward shriveled, her prayers casting smoke into the air. "Please, tell me what to do. Show me something. Let me know you're there." As the last prayer drifted toward the tranquiline halls, she sat back on her heels, numb, wanting to huddle down and forget about her